Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, Happy New Year, friends. This is the first Film Sociology of 2022, and it's an anniversary because we started the first weekend in 2009. So we start year 14 of Film Sociology. I still remember my very first guest was Ed Johnsonat, Sky Point, longtime Nouveau film critic and peer member of the, and one of the founding members of the Indiana Film Journalists Association, and a friend. And we miss you, Ed. We miss you at the meetings and the screenings. So, and I remember the big film we reviewed that week was Frost Nixon. So here's year 14. We're hanging in there. Well, I'm hanging in there. We're going to dip into the archives a little later on, and I'll explain why in a bit. But yeah, it's the first weekend in January. I think everybody has their lists out. Are you listed out yet? Well, that's okay, because now it's time to give mine. I'm obligated to do this at the end of the year, and if you're a new listener to Film Sociology, what cracks me up is, you try to do it at the end of the calendar year, but there's just a glut of lists, not just from writers, but in film critics, but you know, everybody, because of the internet, and so I try to make sure mine is the last that's put out there, although sometimes there are folks that slip it out after me. But and 10 is fine. I crack up when I see people trying to do a list and rank all of the films that came out this year. You know, what points does it make for something to go from number 97 to number 96? I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't think that way. But we got 10, and actually there's more than 10 because it's my list, and, you know, folks like to put ties on there so they add more titles, and guess what? I did that this year. So, all right, let's get cracking. Here we go. Some honorable mentions, Passing in the Heights, The Killing of Two Lovers, Petite Maman, The Worst Person in the World, and The Humans. So check those out. We go to number 10, and we have a tie between Annette and Memoria. Annette, of course, is the musical with Adam Driver, Marion Cotillard, and a puppet baby. Memoria, if you get a chance, is a hypnotic, transcending exercise in minimal sound and movement, starring Tilda Swinton. Both probably the most original films of the year. The reason why it's not ranked higher, I wish both of them were at least 20 to 30 minutes shorter. I think it would still have the same punch that both films were looking for, and for the most part succeeded. But man, those were an experience. And here I especially use this with Annette, and I kind of am with this with Memoria. People who gripe about the lack of originality in Hollywood, well, here's two. Shut up and watch these. But it's also the cinematic equivalent of, what do you want to eat? I don't know. What do you feel like eating? I don't care. Well, what about these films? No, that's what it feels like with these. But if you're a serious film fan, these must be experienced, whether you like it or not. It's a trip. Number 9 is The Lost Daughter. Big directing debut from Maggie Gyllenhaal, anchored by really, really good performances from Olivia Colman and Dakota Johnson. Number 8, West Side Story. Quite the year for musicals, and this wasn't even my favorite musical of this year. But Spielberg, that Spielberg guy, he knows his way around a camera. Really solid singing and dancing. Yeah, we know Tony's the weak link, but he's better than me out there. So anyway, but nice retelling of the story, and not just the correcting of cultural what have you, but really, really done well. And hi, Rita Moreno. Number 7, Joe Wright's Cyrano, anchored by an excellent performance from Peter Dinklage. I hope he gets some nominations, some awards this year. It's also one of those where I feel like I could be a singer I wouldn't say that Cyrano is a musical, but it is a film with some singing in it. And Dinklage has said on more than one occasion he doesn't consider himself a singer. But for me, I am fans of those that maybe aren't the greatest trained voices, because it humanizes the musical. It brings it down to a human level. People gripe about they don't like musicals because people burst in the song out of nowhere. Well, that may be the case. First off, it's a musical. Deal with it. Either like the genre or you don't. But not everybody sounds like Marnie Nixon or the male equivalent of Marnie Nixon. So there you go. A really smart retelling of the story of Cyrano de Bergerac. Number 6, Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog. Excellent performance from Benedict Cumberbatch and Kirsten Dunst. And a fascinating gender politics story set in the Old West. Number 5 is another tie, because why not? And they're both about animals to a certain degree. Pig and lamb. There's a dish. But yeah, fun revenge story from Nicolas Cage, who's not settling a debt with his performance. It's underplayed from underplayed Nick Cage, which is always good. And a revenge story that not only goes into the underworld, but the underground culinary world, and a man and his pig. Lamb is... I know, Abdul, I can hear you rolling your eyes, but Rooney Mara has an excellent performance, and it looks into being stuck out in the middle of nowhere with your animals. Those who consider their pets their children, and I guess there's another film I need to point out, because I didn't like it. And I think not liking that film made me like this film. And I wrote about this on social media a while back. Don't watch Lamb and Splice as a double feature. You don't want to do that. And I remember those who know the film Splice, that's the one with Adrian Brody. The scene with the scientists and the creation, that, oh boy, it happened. You couldn't believe it happened, and I remember seeing this film in a full theater, and people were still chuckling minutes afterwards about what they had just watched. And I apologize. It's Noomi Rapace in Lamb. Sorry about that. I blame Dragon Tattoos for the mix-up. But yeah, it's a bizarre but weirdly sweet film when you're stuck out. And also it asks the question, what is a family? And your family's not mine, and definitely not the ones in the film Lamb. Number 4, Paul Thomas Anderson's Licorice Pizza. I got to finally see this with my daughter at the Neon. If you're ever on the if you're ever in Ohio, in Dayton or on the border, go to the Neon Art House Cinema. It's renovated, it's nicely done. It's interesting that I talked to a couple people online that didn't know what they just watched. And I like to think of it as it's a love story, but it's dressed up in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood clothing. And this is the third period film from Paul Thomas Anderson, set in Los Angeles, Boogie Nights, of course, Inherit Vice. And it's two kids, one's older than the other. I say one's in her 20s, played by Elena Haim, and a teenager played by Cooper Hoffman. And I had the moment where the first profile shot of Cooper Hoffman, he is the son of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And when you reach my age, you start to say things like, oh, there's his dad. I see him now. Just two people who are in a like-love relationship, and they're also trying to find their way. They're both hustlers in their own way, and sometimes it's all in the timing. It also helps that you have Sean Penn, who's not William Holden, he's Jack Holden. And Tom Waits and Bradley Cooper all coming off the bench. But it's like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's a kind of a rambling, shaggy-haired dog of a film, anchored by two really good performances from our leads, Elena Haim and Cooper Hoffman, and great soundtrack. And it was just an enjoyable evening at the movies for me. So that's number four. Number three, the documentary Summer of Soul. And yeah, I probably would have ranked it even higher, even though it's three, about the ad campaign. Yes, I know it was most of this footage was lost. Not all of it, most of it, because some images had come up. But it's still a fascinating, wonderful documentary about a series of music events concerts that happened in a park in Harlem in the summer of 1969. This was also going on during Woodstock. And you have great footage of everybody from the Fifth Dimension, B.B. King, Nina Simone, Sly and the Family Stone. So you get great concert footage. You have witnesses and musicians who were there talking about the event, as well as talking about what was happening in New York and the U.S. in 1969. And it's just a very thorough concert film and documentary. And I hope there's albums. I hope there's CDs of these performances. I would love to share. I'd love to share those on the other thing I do here at WFYI. But yeah, I just thoroughly had a great time watching Summer of Soul. Number two, Mass, or as I put it, if Ingmar Bergman wrote and directed Gods of Carnage or the film Carnage, four people basically opening up wounds on each other. Four excellent performances by your quartet, Jason Isaacs, Martha Plimpton, Ann Dowd, Reed Birney. This is going to be one of those that somebody's going to get canceled out because all four deserve awards and praise and nominations. And we'll just have to see. But you don't do that for the awards. But it's an excellent film. It's a gut punch of a film. And finally, number one, Mike Mills' Come On, Come On. And this is one of those films that just hit at the right time. It's subject matter. And not the NPR part doesn't hit with me as hard. But it's we have a performance artist, Joaquin Phoenix, who has a far better performance in this than in Joker, who has to look over his nephew while his sister is taking care of some family issues. Phoenix has also been on a cross-country trip interviewing children for his radio show. And Phoenix is great. Woody Norman plays the nephew, and there's some lovely chemistry between the two of them. Gabby Hoffman plays the sister/mother. And the uncle-nephew relationship really kind of hits home with me, especially in this one. And if you see me on the street, I'll tell you why. But I think there's a lot when you have storylines that you can relate to. This one did it particularly strong. And it's a road picture. It's a family picture. And it just, like I said, it hit at the right time for me. And I think that's why it's my number one picture. Another note about my list, and this has been happening for a while for me as a critic. The list I just gave you, I'd say one and two, Come On, Come On, and Mass were very, very neck and neck. And then from five all the way through honorable mentions, it's like a horse race. They're all kind of in a clump. So that's just kind of how that configuration happens, that list happened. The other part I always like to bring up is, you know, we are supposed to do a list at the end of the calendar year. But because of the market we live in here in Indiana, there are some films that it doesn't come to town until January, sometimes February. Just a little inside baseball. Studios will release a film by the end of the calendar year and have it open in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, so it can be considered for award consideration. And then it trickles down into the smaller markets as the year goes on. So there are times I tend to do a list revival in end of February, early March, or during Oscar time. So that's kind of because there was one year where my number one film was Brokeback Mountain, and then I saw the Tommy Lee Jones Western, The Three Burials of Maquettis Estrada, which blew me away, and it changed. So that's just an example of that. That's why the fact that Judas and the Black Messiah, which was released last year and got awards for last year, but somehow made the 2021 list for, well, the IFJA. And there were other organizations that did it. I just didn't agree with that. So, sorry. Not really. Not sorry there. So, anyway, there's your list. There it is. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But you should see these films. They're really, really good. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'm going to talk about a couple of films. I'm now catching up on the pile of movies that have been sent to me, and we'll see what's playing around town. And then we'll grab a pencil, and then we'll dip into the archives. But from Film Movement, this was impressive. They had not one, not two, but three films from writer-director Lee Isaac Chung, who burst onto the scene, at least in mainstream audiences, last year with his Academy Award-nominated film, Minari. So there's three of these on Film Movement, all worth checking out for various things. And the versatility of Chung as a filmmaker is very impressive. And these three films, along with Minari, are a great example of that. We start with his debut feature from 2007. I try not to butcher it, called Muri Rangabo, and it's a story of two friends set in Africa, in a small African country, where two guys, one steals a machete. He and his friends start to leave town. They go to a village first of Sangwa, his friend, and Muni, who is the one who stole the machete. And they spend some time there. And it's a story where we find out that one is Hutu and the other is Tutsi, and not supposed to be hanging out together. But at 98 minutes of a film, there's a lot of hanging out on top of tasks that need to be done. And then when there's conversation between the two friends, there's some great tension. All non-actors, but really natural performances from everybody involved, and an interesting road story as well as a little social commentary. The other one is a film called Lucky Life, where friends travel to a beach. One of the friends in the group has been diagnosed with cancer, and the other three friends discuss on how to handle the situation for him as well as for each other. Another very lived-in, natural feel. There's a shift in tone with the film when a couple in the group want to have a child, but it's another one of those kind of art house, well-done, grown-up hangout pictures. And then probably the favorite of the group is Abigail Harm, which has Burt Young coming off the bench. You got Will Patton also coming off the bench, but it's anchored by a really lovely underplayed performance from Amanda Plummer. She's a woman who reads to the blind. Her father has been ill for a long, long time. We learn this right out of the gate. And what happens when a fable starts to come to life? And it's based off a Korean fable where a woodcutter is in her apartment and saves a deer, and the woodcutter, played by Will Patton, arranges a companion for her, which turns out to be a young Korean man. Minimal dialogue blurs the line between fantasy and reality, and what Amanda Plummer's character is going through. There's some lovely chemistry between Plummer and the young Korean actor. I should learn his name. I'm a terrible critic. I'm sorry. Tetsu Kuramachi. So thank you, IMDb, for getting me out of that. It's from the Korean folktale is The Woodcutter and the Nymph. So just a lovely humanistic story involving humans. But all of those are worth checking out from Film Movement. Three films from director Lee Isaac Chung. Also out on Film Movement is a Danish crime drama called Wildland, a story of Ida, a teenage girl, age 17, whose mom dies in a car crash. Ida has to live with her aunt and her three grown male cousins. And while there is love and care in the household, we find out as the film goes on that Ida's new family are a part of a crime syndicate. And if this sounds like Animal Kingdom, yeah, there's a lot of that. If you've not seen Animal Kingdom, the film or the series, I highly recommend the film. Great performance from Jackie Weaver. But it has that similar feel to it. And there's some unsettling moments involving a picking up of a fourth grader to deliver to somebody who owes the family money. There is that aspect of, when is the other shoe going to drop? When does the downfall start? And despite knowing that that's going to happen, there's a really good gut punch of an ending. So from Denmark, look out for Wildland, which is also out on video. And then we come to a French costume drama, or lack of costume, called Curiosa. It's Paris in 1895. We have a love triangle that could become a square, that could become a pentagon. Pierre is a poet, and Marie, they're in love, but she's going into an arranged marriage of convenience with his friend Henri, or Henry. And what happens as time goes on, Henry and Marie get into a marriage of convenience and everything is proper, while he starts taking photographs of nude women, one in particular. And it's very casual talk about nudity and photography. And yeah, there's plenty of nudity in this film. But there's a nice tension between the trio, and then what happens eventually when Pierre and Marie reconnect. He dumps his original muse and brings her in. There's even a moment between Marie and the former muse. So it's a very good looking picture as far as photography. And these are loosely based on real photos and letters of correspondence between the lovers involved. Really lovely pictures and fairly graphic. It's just giving a warning as far as men and women. But it doesn't beat you over the head. This would be a fun double feature with Women in Love, Ken Russell's film. There's a nice electronic score that doesn't turn into a Baz Luhrmann picture. Kudos to the costume and production design on this. But yeah, just a well-done grown-up picture. And the other reason why I bring this up, besides the fact that it was on my list, and I'm sorry I'm late to the party on this, but on the back of the DVD case, I have it here right now, second paragraph on the back, inspired by the erotic photography of its real-life subjects, Curiosa reveals the, quote, sizzling love affair between two famed writers who push the boundaries of expression and sexuality. And that quote is from the film Yap. So way to go, guys. How you doing? Anyway, all of those are worth checking out. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before we grab a pencil, mark these dates down. Over at IU Cinema, they start back up on Thursday, June 13th and Friday, June 14th at 7 p.m. as a part of the International Art House series, LAM. Gotta see it. Friday, January 14th at 10 o'clock as a part of the Not Quite Midnight series, 2009's Diablo Cody film, Jennifer's Body. Thursday, January 20th, it's part of the Staff Select series at 7 o'clock, programmed by IU Cinema House Manager Ava Clouden, Tron Legacy, which I remember seeing on the IMAX screen. Looks great. Didn't really need a second one, but, you know, some of y'all all like that. And I'm sure Mr. Bridges enjoyed the second check more than the first Tron check. Friday, the 21st of January at 7 o'clock is a part of the International Art House series, The Rescue. And then at 10 o'clock at the Not Quite Midnight series, Titane. Sunday, January 23rd at 1 o'clock, The Rescue will be screened once again. All of that is happening at IU Cinema. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, January 7th and 8th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., if you get a chance to see it on the big screen, the Elvis Presley movie Kid Galahad with Gig Young, Lola Albright, Charles Bronson, one of the better underappreciated Elvis movies. And, of course, January the 8th is Elvis's birthday. And kudos to John Krall, who I normally would play this interview on this week's show because of Elvis's birthday, but maybe another time. I'm sorry, John. But always thinking of you with the films of Elvis Presley. January 14th and 15th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Muppets Take Manhattan. January 21st and 22nd, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Operation Petticoat. And January 28th and 29th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. That's a quick turnaround with the two screenings in one day. And over at Can-Can Indy this weekend, they are showing A Hero, Kubo and the Two Strings, Dawn Chronicles 3, End of Dawn. Coming soon on January 15th is House of Gucci, presented with Pattern. Drive My Car, Spirited Away. Coming January 28th is Parallel Mothers. Fleas coming, F-L-E-E, on February 4th. So, and February 18th, The Worst Person in the World. Go to cancanindy.com for all the information over there. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. We start on Facebook with John, who writes, Don't Look Up, West Side Story, and Tick, Tick, Boom. Glenn writes, Passing and Don't Look Up. Linda writes, Encanto. Mike Perry, I need to get Mike back on the show if he's willing. Mike Perry writes, The Snyder Cut. Linda writes, All the Harry Potter. Okay, all the movies, I'm guessing. Macho, I'm assuming you mean Cry Macho, the Clint Eastwood film, and Saints of Newark. Rachel writes, I loved The Eyes of Tammy Faye. I didn't see as many new things as I typically would this year, but because I was still comfort viewing. So also my 800th viewing of Soap Dish. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. Anthony writes, Jennifer's Body, The Prestige, all the Matrix movies, Fantastic Fungi, and The Biggest Little Farm. Emma will pop up on that one. She enjoys that. She doesn't pop up on it, but she endorses it. Wayne writes, Don't Look Up, Pig, No Way Home, and Licorice Pizza. Dustin writes, Singing in the Rain and Calamity Jane. A poet and didn't know it. Molly writes, Red Rocket, Licorice Pizza, and God Knows Where I Am. Stacy writes, All of the Spider-Man movies, Homecoming, Far From Home, No Way Home. Well, that's not all of them, but anyway, there's more of those, Stacy. I see where you're going. Okay. Tracy writes, Encanto, Sing 2, No Time to Dive. No Time to Die, and Ron's Gone Wrong. Mary writes, Coal Miner's Daughter, Fried Green Tomatoes, Night in Casablanca, and A Day at the Circus. All right. Rob writes, Day of Wine and Roses. It is dry January for some folks. Rachel writes, Titanic, and Every Time I Become More Impressed with Kate and Less So with Leo. Leo's gotten better since Titanic, so there's that. And Kate's just unstoppable. David writes, Don't Look Up and The Lost Daughter. Nikki writes, The Game, The Princess Diaries, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Chronicles of Narnia. Very good. Evan Dossie discovered The Mighty Peking Man and absolutely loves it. Going with one of the best movies I've ever seen. So, yeah, it's something to have some pizza and a few beers and then check that out. Stephen writes, In a Lonely Place, The Lost Daughter, and The Little Foxes. And as he writes, you know, all those L films. I know. Chris writes, Shakespeare in Love. Craig writes, The Electrical Life of Lewis Wayne and The Battle of Britain, revisiting after reading a book on the making of. Thank you, Craig. I did like Electrical Life of Lewis Wayne. I knew a little bit about the drawings more than I did the man. It's a Benedict Cumberbatch performance that's going to be overshadowed by The Power of the Dog. But great footage and a man obsessed with finding his energy, his expression of his artistic energy. So, Mike writes, Don't Look Up. Darlene writes, Being the Ricardos. Matt writes, Throne of Blood, Gravity, and the 39 Steps. David writes, Matrix Resurrections, The French Dispatch, The Nice Guys, and Don't Look Up. Emma woos somewhere in the world when she hears the film The Nice Guys. Robert writes, Don't Look Up. Enjoyed it. Kevin writes, The Big Street. Kim writes, No Time to Die, Free Guy, and dubbed it Grandson's Pick. Bombshell, and From the Vines. Lou Harry writes, The Gang's All Here, Quiet Place 2, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Wow, Lou, you saw the film version of it and not a musical stage version of it. All right. Emily writes, Encanto. Sam Watermeyer writes Scream 2, The Strange Things About the Johnsons, and the Bukowski tapes. Man, reading's a skill. Nick Rogers writes Die Hard with a Vengeance, Live Free or Die Hard, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and the Chamber of Secrets, and the Prisoner of Azkaban, as well as C for me. Christy writes, my daughter and I are in the middle of a movie musical marathon. Les Mis, Hairspray, Sound of Music, both Mamma Mia's, both Grease's, Annie, Christmas Story Live, Sweeney Todd. And then there's The Lightning Thief, okay, Come From Away, Tick, Tick, Boom, the original West Side Story, all of the High School Musicals, oh my gosh, and Chicago. Very good. Pat writes, Don't Look Up, as in refers to it as Death of 2021. Andrea writes, Don't Look Up, Harry Potter's 20th Reunion, and Carnage. Oh, Andrea, then now you got to watch Mass. Kevin writes, Panic in the Streets, Ilya Kazan, 1950. I'm glad you saw that. I talked about it on the show last year with Michael Doucet. Gorgeous film, gorgeous black and white film. It was funny because I talked about how I have no desire to see the Steven Soderbergh film Contagion because of what we've been going through for the last almost 2 years. But Panic in the Streets was on my Blu-ray pile. And it's a story about a naval officer played by Richard Widmark who is trying to solve a crime and find one of the perpetrators who does have a virus which could cause a major plague. Jack Palance is in it, a young Zero Mostel, shot in New Orleans by Ilya Kazan, and just on location, and it looks great. But I did watch that. So, Kevin, I'm glad you got to watch that as well. Eric writes, Don't Look Up. Taylor writes, The Thin Man series, Trouble in Paradise, the 1925 Three Musketeers, and Baby Snakes. Doug writes, A bunch from 2021, Licorice Pizza, Shang-Chi, Luca, House of Gucci, The Lost Daughter, In Memory of Mario Van Peebles, Watermelon Man, and the two that were recently inducted into the National Film Registry, Chicana and The Watermelon Woman. And yeah, Doug, we'll get to the National Film Registry in a little bit. Thank you for reminding me. Sean writes The Suicide Squad and Baywatch. Linda writes, If it counts that we saw West Side Story in the theater, then that's my comment. Simple title is fine, Linda, but that's okay. Kate writes, Don't Look Up. Rachel writes, Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings, The Color of Magic, Nicholas Nickleby, and No Deposit, No Return. Judy writes, a documentary on WBCN and the American Revolution, and Lawn Dogs. Megan writes, Don't Look Up, Laughed Until I Cried, and Then I Cried Because It Could Actually Happen. Jessica writes, Harry Potter's 1, 2, 3, and 5, not 4, Fiddler on the Roof, Isle of Dogs, and It's a Wonderful Life. Eric writes, Across 110th Street, Breezy, and Don't Look Up. And then adds, after finish watching all 15 seasons, 331 episodes of Michael Crichton's ER, an addiction begun in mid-September and completed on New Year's Day. Blame it on Hulu. Congratulations, Eric. There is that feeling of when you get a series finished and you feel like there's a huge weight taken off your head on top of, all right, now what am I going to watch? So, yeah, that's a big one, Eric. I'm glad you brought up Breezy because I mentioned earlier in the film Licorice Pizza, Sean Penn plays Jack Holden, not William Holden. Can't wait to find out about that. But the female lead, her character has an audition with William Holden, and it turns out to be a May-December romance film that's not mentioned, but I know at that time, 1973, that's when the film is set, that he appeared in a film called Breezy, directed by Clint Eastwood, about an older man with a younger woman, in that film played by Kay Lenz. So, yeah, nice touch there. Oh, and Bradley Cooper is supposed to be John Peters. You can watch A Star is Born if you want. All right, back to the list. Nancy writes, The Power of the Dog, loved it. Free Guy, More Rom Than Come, eh. That's hers. Galaxy Quest, I will never not watch this when it's on. And Pig, pleasantly surprised by how much I like the film. Nick Cage is better doing the quirky roles. Yeah, I kind of miss off-kilter 80s Nicolas Cage, but... You got to do what you got to do, I guess. Mark writes Lady Macbeth. Jonathan writes Don't Look Up and Spider-Man Homecoming. Jamie writes Return to Hogwarts, Four Pirates of the Caribbeans, Shrek 2, and The Croods. John writes Mikey and Nikki, Criterion version. Yeah, Peter Falk, John Cassavetes, Ned Beatty. Nice twist on the typical mob movie. Yeah, John, and Elaine May wrote and directed that. And I finally watched it last year. There was a certain company had a certain 50% off sale, and I got it, and I'm really glad I did. And it's interesting because I think people assume it's a Cassavetes film because you have John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, but it is not. But a really, really nice crime drama. And then John writes, with the kids, My Neighbor Totoro, A Bug's Life, and Up, which he adds, I'm not crying, you're crying. Kayla writes a new Spider-Man film. Joshua writes Swan Song, Pig, really impressed with this one, Downhill, Bad Education, and Young Guns 2. Corey writes Don't Look Up, Duplex, Riding in the Car with Boys, In Her Shoes, and the musical version of Reefer Madness. Amy writes Queen Pins, fun movie. Lily writes Don't Look Up, I actually liked it. Robert Muggy, once again, I got to get him back on the show. He comes loaded with titles, sorry. The Lost Daughter, No Time to Die, Women in Love, Casino, Tick, Tick, Boom, Angels Wear White, Crime Wave, that's the Andre Dutoff film, Platinum Blonde, and The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. Very good. Daniel writes Nightmare Alley, the most recent version, Little Evil, Shadow of the Thin Man, Licorice Pizza, St. Narcisse, Two for the Road, and The Sound of Music. Michael writes All That Heaven Allows. Abdul writes Don't Look Up. Matt writes Star Trek First Contact. Devin writes Don't Look Up. Beverly writes Master of Disguise and Griswold Family Christmas. Or do you mean National Christmas Vacation? I don't know. That's fine. Megan writes, I also watched the Harry Potter reunion and failed to believe that I am that much older. Only the actors aged 20 years. Okay, Megan, sure. Chris Lloyd writes, The Seduction of Joe Tynan and Inheritance Italian Style, and that's it. Yes, Chris, you are in post-award screening cool-down. Nothing wrong with that. I'm sure all of our families are relieved. Andrew writes Dune. Mike writes Don't Look Up. Glenn writes The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Britt writes Emma, The Philadelphia Story, Bell Book and Candle, The Pirate, Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, Don't Look Up, The Star, and Muppet Christmas Carol. The Emma was the most recent one with Anya Taylor-Joy. Emily writes Encanto. Again, actually for the fifth time, it's just really good. And The Aeronauts, which I enjoyed more than I expected. David writes A Little Chaos, Don't Look Up, Jungle Cruise, The Artist, Keith Richards, Under the Influence, way to go, David, The Bishop's Wife, hi, Helen, and Attack of the Hollywood Clichés. Jeff writes Pig. Kurt writes, oh, man, 101 Reykjavik, sorry, pardon my Icelandish, 2001 A Space Odyssey While in the Hotel. Kurt's just coming back from Iceland. Yesterday and the Downton Abbey movie, as well as Bjorn and Forlander, two Icelandic films, which means children and parents, respectively. I saw both on flights years ago and have revisited them on this trip. Very cool, Kurt. Safe travels. Everin writes Don't Look Up. Don writes Don't Look Up. I don't know if they watch them together. I don't think so. Cassie writes Eye in the Sky. Gary writes Audition, The Matrix Resurrections, Born Losers, a.k.a. Tommy Chong, and Fight Club. Gary watched the first of the Billy Jack films. Very good. JJ writes Lost Daughter, Eyes of Tammy Faye, and Down Argentine Way. Melissa writes Silent Night, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and Good on Paper. James writes Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne. Dylan writes The Fisher King and Paddington 2. Dee Dee, Drinks with Dee Dee, Dee Dee Servino, writes The Matrix Resurrections. Alan writes The Hand of God and the original Nightmare Alley. Helen writes The Dig and Encanto. Helen, don't forget your Lily James movie glasses. Martin writes Don't Look Up, fun. Austin of Medium Cool Podcast, soon, I swear. Come On, Come On, Licorice Pizza, as well as Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, and Prisoner of Azkaban. Jesse writes, Hidden Away, Mario, It's a Wonderful Life, Philadelphia Story, Rainy Day in New York, and Cherry 2000. Cassandra writes, surprisingly, we've watched more movies than normal since Christmas. It's nice when the hubby has some time off. Understood. Spider-Man No Way Home, Sing 2, 310 to Yuma, which one? Tick, Tick, Boom, and Trial of the Chicago 7. We've also gotten into several Netflix series like Hawkeye, Stories of a Generation with Pope Francis, The Witcher, and Arcane. Mindy writes, the 3.5-hour long documentary on TCM, My Journey Through French Cinema. Great. Dense. Khalif writes, don't look up. And then said, don't waste your time seeing the new Matrix. Lucinda writes, don't look up, Jurassic Park 3, and Independence Day. Terry writes, Last Train from Gun Hill, The Vikings, The Comedians from 1967, and In the Soup. Mia writes, The Lost Daughter. Joni writes, The Lost Daughter, Hang 'em High, Serendipity, and Silverado. Sarah writes, Tenet. David writes, The Green Knight, The French Dispatch, and Licorice Pizza. Mark writes, The Power of the Dog, Don't Look Up, and House of Gucci. Kurt writes, saw Being the Ricardos. Ms. Kidman killed it, as did Javier Bardem. Only fell asleep once them damn chairs are so comfortable. Oh, the theater. Sorry, Kurt. Yeah, that happens. Hang in there. Watch it again. It's streaming. Brent writes, The Lost Daughter. Christopher writes, The Thin Man. Pat writes, A Repeat Performance, a film noir from the 1940s that foretold The Twilight Zone. And I'm gonna name drop. That's Pat Duggins, who sent me that. So thank you, Pat. Julia writes, Licorice, Breezy, and then she says, watch because of Licorice Pizza, and William Holden is unsurprisingly great. It is, if you're into May-December romance, or, you know, older guy, younger girl films, and this was the 70s, it's an underrated film. This was a big deal because it was the first film that Eastwood directed but did not appear in. And I'm sure that's, you know, his success with his earlier pictures, you know, got him a little bit of cachet, especially when your first film as a director is Play Misty for Me. But anyway, Julia also watched Skyfall and the 1994 version of Little Women. Kathy writes, West Side Story, A Journal for Jordan, The King's Man, and The Tender Bar. Because of the list, I'm going to say the most recent West Side Story, my guess. Debbie writes, Hell or High Water, Don't Look Up, and Christine. Now, this is another one where, is it John Carpenter's film or the one with Rebecca Hall, who was named Best Actress for her performance in that by the Indiana Film Journalists Association? Joe writes, I lose track pretty easily these days, but I just started Living in Oblivion a little bit ago, and it's good so far. Thank you, Joe. Understood. Time is funny that way. Tom writes, Unforgivable, The Laundromat, and The Forgotten Battle. Michelle writes, Star Trek from 2009, Die Hard 2, and Book of Eli. Michelle, did you see me in it? Got to press pause. I'll show it to you sometime. Joni writes, The Pajama Game, and Don't Look Up. Aggie writes, After watching Don't Look Up, revisited some of the disaster classics from the 1970s, Towering Inferno, Poseidon Adventure, and Marooned. And I'm going to be that guy and mention, I think Maroon's 1969. Oh, well. Michael writes, A Streetcar Named Desire. Maya writes, Don't Look Up. Anthony writes, Encanto. And finally, David writes, Don't Look Up. So there you are, friends. That's what you've been watching. So hopefully you got some ideas, and hopefully you get to watch some movies that are good and new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. I'm going to shift gears for a little bit. I want to talk about two people, dead people we like, because we never have dead time for dead people we don't like. And then we'll dip into the archives with my interview with Elmore Leonard. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. Of course, I know a lot of folks were bummed out that Betty White did not make it to 100 years old, came really close. But I think somebody also counted in the number of leap year days there are. I don't know. But, you know, got her money's worth. And while known primarily through television, There were still a handful of films, especially in the latter half of her career, where, you know, she was used for stunt casting, but still kept her visible, still kept her on screen, on stage, on television. I forgot that she played Senator Bessie Adams in 1962's Advise and Consent, which I need to revisit sometime. Yes, hot scrolling here at Film Sociology. I forgot she had the moment in Hard Rain, Holy Man, Lake Placid. Yeah, that's a fun moment in Lake Placid. It's one of the highlights, a few highlights of Lake Placid. The Story of Us, the voice of Aunt Polly in a video game version of Tom Sawyer. He gets high on you. The Proposal, of course, is another. That's one of her better kind of feisty older lady performances. Is one of the voices in the English soundtrack of Ponyo from 2008, Love and Dancing, You Again, The Lorax. I forgot she was in The Lorax. Her voice is in The Lorax. And yes, she was Bitey White in Toy Story 4, and one of the voices in Trouble. So salute to Betty, and Max Julian. So I know blaxploitation fans are really, really bummed out about this. Now, of course, he's best known as Goldie from The Mac from 1973. He created the creator of Cleopatra Jones, which he really wanted to have his other half, Vonetta McKee, to play. But he wanted her to do it, and Warner Brothers wound up going with Tamara Dobson. So he created those characters and was a co-producer on it. And then he and Vonetta eventually a year later made their film together, the 1974 Western Thomasine and Bushrod, which you need to check out. It's a kind of a black Western Bonnie and Clyde. But a handful of only 15 acting credits for Max Julian, but made an impact, obviously. 1966 is The Black Klansman, 1968 Psych Out, 1968's The Savage Seven, as well as 1968's Uptight, great score by Booker T and EMGs. Getting Straight from 1970, The Mac, of course, we mentioned, Thomasine and Bushrod, jump to 1997, he's Uncle Fred in How to Be a Player, and also in the short film Sugar Free featuring Cat Williams and Mac Julian, as well as appearances on TV shows like One-on-One, Restore, CBS Playhouse, Mod Squad, and The Bold Ones. So salute to you, Max Julian. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, one of the films, been trying to catch up on some films that have been sent to me, as well as some films I recently purchased. I listened to the commentary track for Clint Eastwood's film High Plains Drifter, as well as the Burt Reynolds movie Stick. So I grew up as a big Burt Reynolds fan because I was a knuckleheaded boy in the 70s. And of course, by the time Stick came out in 85, much troubled production, which I kind of knew back then. It was supposed to come out in 83, didn't come out till spring of 85. There was injuries, there was health issues, there were reshoots. And the commentary track on this filled me in on that stuff, which I knew, but as well as a handful of other items that I didn't know about. And I realized from watching it again recently that there is a subgenre of Florida noir, which some of which I need to revisit. I know Wild Things, I believe, is an example of that. Miami Blues is another one in which the screenwriter, not Elmore Leonard, I think, later worked on. But I always remember the review. I think it was Newsweek, and I might be wrong. But it was one of those that the film didn't do well theatrically with critics or at the box office. But I remember somebody writing that Burt Reynolds took an Elmore Leonard novel and turned it into a Mickey Spillane film. There was also part of me that looked like Burt Reynolds was trying to make Miami Vice with Uzis and black magic and stuff that had nothing to do with the original novel. But I will say this about the film. I wound up liking it more than the friends of mine that I dragged to go see it when it came out. It did get me interested in the novels of Elmore Leonard because I wound up buying the paperback for Stick and find out what happened and where did it change. And that started an obsession with the novels of Elmore Leonard. And I've been a fan ever since. So years and years ago, I got to see Elmore Leonard speak at Butler and got him to sign one of my books. And I told him about the film show, and he gave me his number. And I know Joe Scheer has a similar story, and he'd had it done before me. But I got to interview Elmore Leonard, which is one of the highlights of my career. And because I revisited Stick, which, you know, I still think you should check out. Dar Robinson's great in it as Moki, and also the stunt, one of the best stuntmen ever, and does a very impressive stunt at the end of the film. But anyway, this is also an excuse for me to dip into the archives. Here's my long-form chat with the writing great Elmore Leonard. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is a writer that makes me proud to be a writer who grew up in Michigan, Elmore Leonard. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Just
writing a book.
What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm writing a book based, it's a Raylan book. Raylan, who's in Justified.
Mm-hmm.
I've already written two books that he stars in, so I thought, what the heck? Well, Justified is running. I might as well write another one. And maybe they can use some of it, which they are going to do a little bit here and there. But it's a novel. It's not really based on anything that they're doing on the show.
Have you enjoyed the show so far?
I think it's great. It's so amazing that it seems so lifelike. It's so realistic the way they talk. I can't believe it.
Well, the source doesn't fall too far from the tree, sir.
Well, they did wear those little bracelets that said, "Well, what would Elmore do?" You know, that was nice. That was
right.
That was kind of.
Now, when you're creating characters, do you know ones, whether you're writing or when you finish, that you know you're going to use again in future books?
No, never. But at least I don't think about it.
Okay.
But I'll see, for example, I'll see a photograph in the newspaper, a couple of marshals standing in front of the federal courthouse in Miami, and the woman has a shotgun on her, the stock is on her hip, and she's holding it up at an angle, and she's good looking. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I got to use her. No question about it. Or when I met the guy named Raylan, I was in, in Texas? Amarillo, I think. And I was giving a talk at a luncheon, a book company that, they're not a publishing company, but they provide the books to bookstores and so on. And I was introduced to this fellow who was going to introduce me, and he said, "Hi, I'm Raylan." I said, "Raylan, God, I got to use your name if it's okay." I said, "That's perfect," and I've used it twice.
Now, have people come out of the woodworks claiming that they were the inspiration for some of your characters in the past?
I haven't heard it. No.
Okay. The current crisis going on in Detroit, whether it's the government or that's money or the city declining, has that been inspiration for future work?
No. No, but I use Detroit because I know it. I've been here since the fourth grade. There's a lot of activity, but it's a big, robust, rowdy town, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed it here. It's fallen on bad times. There's no question about that. The people who know how to make cars, they're still around, but they've moved out to suburbs. There are about 900,000 people living in Detroit, but all the suburbs are bustling, and that's where they live. But I just heard today that it's going to be tougher for auto workers who don't have necessary skills, that it's going to be different now in the area of manufacturing. They're going to have to learn a new way of doing things. So I don't know. I suppose they will. You know, what happened to all the blacksmiths? I'm sure they got a job.
Eventually. If you don't mind me asking, what part of town do you live on?
I live out in Bloomfield Village, which is, 16 miles north of Detroit.
Yes.
Well, the line, the Detroit line is at 8 Mile, and we're at We live just north of 15, near 16 Mile Road.
Well, going back a little bit, what were some of the movies you watched growing up, and did they have any inspiration to you when it became when you wanted to be a writer?
Yes, one in particular, All Quiet on the Western Front, and it was released in 1931. I saw it; it kept coming back. I mean, this was before television, but I saw it at least twice in movie theaters. And I was inspired in the fifth grade to write a play. That was 1935. And I wrote a World War I play where the Germans were on one side of the classroom and the Americans were on the other, and one of the Americans crawls under the desk, which is no man's land, and gets caught and gets shot, and somebody has to go out and save him. And I think it was the coward of the outfit who goes out and saves them. I'm not sure now. I wish I had that script. It'd be valuable. but we put it on one performance in the classroom, and that was it. So our teacher, the sister who was our homeroom, well, we were always in the same room, and the mother superior of the school came and watched it, and that was it. That was the first thing I'd ever written. I didn't write really anything else until college. And then right after I got out of college, I started writing Westerns because I saw a wonderful market for them, with especially pulp magazines and also Saturday Evening Post and Collier's. The bigger pay magazines were always running Westerns. I finally did sell one to the Post. But I sold, while I was working at an ad agency, I sold at least 30 short stories, and most of those were to the pulp magazines, Dime Western and 10 Story Western, like that. They paid 2 cents a word. 310 to Yuma, I got $90 for, but it was made into two movies.
Correct.
I still didn't make any money off them.
You mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front. Did the film inspire you to read the book, and were there other examples of that you saw a movie and you wanted to read it?
Well, it was, I think in 1935, it was in the Detroit Times, the whole book, probably over several issues, you know.
Right.
And I remember lying on the floor reading it in our living room and thinking, God, this would be a good play. And I don't know why I thought of play. You know, it's probably the only time in my life I ever thought in that way about a play, because I certainly haven't thought about it lately.
You never wrote any more plays after that?
No.
Do you ever see the film Rushmore?
That sounds familiar.
Wes Anderson?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if I did, though.
Well, there's a scene where it's set in a private high school, and the lead character does stage versions of movies, and one of the movies he stages is Out of Sight.
Really?
Yeah, he does the trunk. You see the trunk scene.
Oh.
You can add that to your rental list.
You know, people, directors who were thinking about doing that one, they said, God, that's a great scene. In the dark. And one of them, the one who finally did it, Summer...
Soderbergh.
Huh?
Steven Soderbergh.
Anyway, he said, I'm going to do it. I want to do that scene screen black. I said, why? I think you'll lose a lot of your audience. Well, he didn't do it that way, but there were so many different ways of doing it that everybody liked that scene.
Well, going back to movies you watched younger, was there ever a film that you read the book and then you saw the movie and you thought, what in God's name did they do? Because it seemed like that happened to quite a bit of your work in the future.
Yeah, it has. No, I don't recall looking at them that way.
Okay.
No, but I wanted to write movies immediately because I wanted to make money. That was my whole idea. Getting into writing and developing a particular style that I liked, and selling to the movies had to be, and I did. I saw 1953. I saw my first one, which was 310 to Yuma.
What happened? They called you and they offered, and that was it?
My agent. I had an agent, and he called me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And what did you think of the film?
It was. It wasn't 310 to Yuma. I wrote it in 53, but it didn't come out until 57.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed there were two titles: Moment of Vengeance and The Tall T. I believe before 310.
Moment of Vengeance was a TV thing. That was in the Saturday Evening Post, a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was on the Slitz Playhouse, and it was okay. You know, wasn't anything special. But the first one was the first movie was The Big Bounce. And I remember saying to my agent, I said, this is the second worst movie I ever saw. And then they remade it just like 5 years ago.
Yeah, I remember.
And I said, well, now I know what the worst movie is. They didn't seem to know what they were doing. They shot it in Hawaii. It took place up in the Thumb area of Michigan.
I know within 310 to Yuma, and I know you also, Hombre was later made into a movie.
Yeah, about 67, I think it was.
Did that one fare any better for you?
Oh, yeah, I liked Hombre a lot. Didn't get a very good review in Time Magazine or Newsweek, but I loved it. I thought it really worked. And I remember in the theater, everybody in the end, Newman is shot at the end of the picture, and then the end credits come on, and everybody just sat there because they didn't believe anybody would shoot Paul Newman or he would die in a movie, you know.
And for that time, Newman was also one of the the time-honored tradition of the white man playing Indians.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, I read that I think your first screenplay credit was The Moonshine War.
Yeah.
How was that experience, and how did it come about?
It was about a guy who made whiskey in Kentucky in 32. It was against the law, of course, and he kept it hidden. And the revenuers are always looking for his whiskey. And finally, I don't really remember what the story was, but it was not a good movie. I just I saw it a couple of times, and that was it.
It seems like when you wrote a screenplay, did you approach it any different than, say, writing one of your novels?
No, I approached it, though, as though I were adapting the novel. I mean, I didn't look for any other ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to me always to make sense, that they would make good pictures. I remember I did one, God, I forgot what it was, for TriStar. The one that I did for TriStar, I remember I went to a meeting there, and these three guys were sitting at a table and looking at me, and the guy in the middle said, "Well, all you did was turn the book into a screenplay." I said, "Yes, that's what I did." And he said, "Well, hell, anybody can do that. You know, you just use the film way of writing instead of prose." This is where I saw that. I hadn't thought of anything new and different to put in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was necessary. And that's when I began to realize I should not be writing movies. So finally, in 93, I quit.
Now, I can't remember. Was Mr. Majestic a novel first and then a film, or was it the other way around?
It was a screenplay first.
Okay.
And then I remember my agent saying, "You're going to have to add a lot of descriptions to make this book length." I said, "No, you add a lot of dialogue. You add it going down, up and down, not across, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So that worked fine. I'm still getting residuals for Mr. Majestic. What was that? That came out in 73.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, you know, 40-something years later.
If you don't mind me asking, are you getting a number of checks for different films? I know, or if not all of them.
Well, I'm always surprised when one that's not very good, the Moonshine War, I'll get $100 or $123 for that, or one I did for Eastwood, Joe Kidd.
Mm-hmm.
I'll finally get a residual for that one, which was not a good movie at all. I listened to the director.
What did he tell you?
Well, he said, this guy who is your bad guy, he said, I think he should be a good guy. He should be, well, once you get rid of your bad guy and he's going to turn out to be good, then who's the bad guy? Mm-hmm. You know, then I have to name somebody who worked for him, and it was just too contrived.
It seems like for a long, long time that directors didn't know what to do with the screenplay, or, as you said, rewrote it themselves.
Yeah. Well, directors do a lot of rewriting.
Even though you get a credit, I think of, and say what you will about the film Stick, it did inspire me to start reading your novels. I will give it that. Yeah, I was a Burt Reynolds fan, and I saw the film, and then I read the really scathing reviews, and I remember, what was it, Newsweek, I said that Burt Reynolds took an Elmore Leonard novel and turned it into a Mickey Spillane film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had some friends that said, look, if you should really read his novel and check out what happened. And,
yeah.
And I remember reading it going, how could you drop the ball on this?
Well, the first thing he said was, Burt, he mm-hmm. said, I thought I'd leave my hairpiece off for this one. I said, yeah? But what he meant was he would wear a much smaller hairpiece that looked like he had just gotten a haircut or something.
Uh-huh.
But it was his kind of a picture. It was he always made the scenes bigger than they were in the book. If there's a party a lawn party at someone's house where there were maybe six people there. Well, he brought in 100 people, and then he has boats passing in front of them with all lit up, you know. He's that old school of let's add more to it if it's a movie, you know. That was a terrible movie.
Did I hear you? I remember reading in an article once that you had the poster in your office and you changed the tagline from the film.
Oh yeah.
The only thing you couldn't stick to was the script.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you still have that?
No, it was in the bathroom.
So you have. You have posters that are
no,
in certain
I don't
rooms?
I have any in the house.
Okay, I was saying. It sounds like the bathroom reflects the product.
Yeah, my barber has about a half dozen of them on his walls.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll have to find that.
Good, too.
And finally in the 90s, it seemed like you had a good streak with Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight. What do you think happened? Or were people finally starting to appreciate your work?
Well, it took me a long time to be discovered. I was writing I started in the 50s, 60s, 70s. It wasn't until 85 that I hit the bestseller list, the Times list.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a New York Times review where I was discovered. The guy says, hey, this guy, I think he's writing better than anybody I can think of, you know?
But I know Get Shorty, I think, was the first of them. Do you remember being approached by Barry Sonnenfeld to have that film made?
I heard that Travolta was going to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my agent, I said, God, don't sell it. Don't sell it. Because he was in Look Who's Talking. I thought, I don't think he's the guy for this one. But it turned out he was. He was good in it.
Well, and he had just come off of Pulp Fiction, and I remember seeing interviews with Quentin Tarantino, who was praising your work to everybody who would listen.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember, I think in Rolling Stone magazine, the review started with the fact that that Elmore Leonard was writing Pulp Fiction long before Quentin Tarantino ever uttered his first F.U.
Yeah, he was a big fan from the beginning.
When did he start getting in touch with you about adapting Rum Punch?
I only talked to him two or three times on the phone, and he told me that he was going to cast Robert, what was his name?
Forster.
Yeah, Forster. I said, Robert Forster? He hasn't been in a picture in 20 years. He was in that something in Chicago during the convention.
Oh, medium cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right. And he says, oh, no, he's good. Well, and he didn't tell me, though, that he was also casting Pam Grier. But I was, whatever he wanted to do was okay with me because I always liked his stuff.
So, yeah, you were a fan of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
It's funny. I interviewed Fred Williamson many years ago, and he worked with Forrester in many films. And his joke complaint was he had Forrester play that character for years, and then he works with some other director and gets a nomination for it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think Tarantino's adaptation was probably the closest of any picture that was made of mine.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I suppose, once he cast Pam Grier, then he's on his way. He knows who the girl is, and she's the main character.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the story. It was my story all the way.
Is that your favorite of the group, as if you have favorites?
I think that might be.
You get executive producer credits for some of these films, like Jackie Brown and Be Cool and Kill Shot and Justified. Is there any input, or did they just throw you that title?
I think I was just given that, yeah.
And I know I read on IMDb you have a production credit for apparently pre-production for Freaky Deaky. Do you know anything of that?
We haven't made it yet, have we?
No, it says pre-production.
Oh, pre-production. No, I don't know who's doing it.
I'm not at my computer right now, but I can check later and tell you. But that's just a piece of information I got off the internet.
Yeah.
Of all the films, what actor captured one of your characters the best?
I suppose Travolta.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I was surprised. Because when I told my agent that, God, don't sell it to them, then I found out that he was in Pulp Fiction, was just released then. And I got to see it, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm glad he's in it, because he was perfect.
I say, have there been any films that you've watched recently? I don't know how often you go to the movies. I was just curious.
Well, I get them now.
Okay.
Because, the Oscars, I get them all.
Did your votes win?
I thought The King's Speech would win, or the other one was that Sorkin wrote. I liked Sorkin's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great script, and I thought it's between those two.
Right.
But I was happy with The King's Speech because I liked it a lot.
Yeah, me too. I say, I have a Michigan question because you set Kill Shot in Algonac, or part of it in Algonac. What brought that on?
Well, I don't know. I suppose just to do it. Set it locally. Maybe I couldn't think of anywhere else.
I only ask because I have friends that live there, and I remember giving them a copy of the book as a gift, and they were quite tickled.
Oh,
did you like that film version at all?
Oh, it was I thought it was disappointing to me that they didn't end it the way the book ends.
Mm-hmm.
Where she shoots the guy, you know, and leaves it up to her husband because he was kind of, he didn't have much of a part in it at all. And the fact that they were breaking up at one point, I thought it was just thrown in for plot because in the book, they are in love with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously. And they'll get into fights, into arguments, but it's over in a moment, you know.
And I remember when you spoke at Butler that was the ending for the second 310 to Yuma changed at the last minute?
I don't know. I think it, because the writers, I did speak to the writers, and they were here doing another one. They said, we didn't understand it, but the director wanted, who was the guy? Who was the head hero?
Russell Crowe? Christian
Bale? Russell
okay.
Crowe. They wanted him to shoot his own guys and then get on the train. And they wrote it that way. And it didn't make any sense to me, nor it did to them. But they did it. I don't know what it meant.
If you don't mind me asking, how far are you into your new project?
I'm on page 272.
You just write until it ends?
And I don't know how it ends yet. But I want to end it in about 30 or 40 pages.
Okay.
So I've got to think about how to end it.
What's the earliest you've ever written something and you knew how it was going to end?
It was Valdez's Coming.
Really?
Yeah, because I knew that one. I thought of it, and I remember calling my agent in Hollywood and saying, I've got one for, and let's see, who was it going to be? I forgot the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you get a producer in the office, and I'll sell it to him in 10 minutes. And he said, kiddo, write your book. But I did it in about 7 weeks, 7 or 8 weeks, which is the fastest I've ever written a book.
Did you envision Burt Lancaster?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You did?
Yeah.
Because he had a couple of interesting westerns at that time as well. There was also Lawman and Ulzana's Raid, and I thought they were pretty dark westerns for that time.
Yeah, especially Ulzana's Raid, yeah.
Some people have written and some people have rumored that the Shorty and Get Shorty was inspired by Dustin Hoffman. Do you know if that's true?
Well, no, but he was up for playing the part at
I
one
see.
Time. And I said, the guy isn't that short. Because he, Get Shorty was just get this guy who was a popular star, you know, that's all. And a lot of them are short. So, and that's why.
Well, I'm 5'5". They seem okay to me.
Oh, good. But Get, I don't know. Get Shorty just sort of came along as a title.
Okay.
And I didn't start with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because then when they got to Travolta, well, who's Get Shorty? Well, then at the very end, the woman production worker says, they're all short. You shoot up.
Back in the days when you also put them on a box in a kissing scene.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I just remember reading a long time ago, I think for a brief period, that Hoffman was linked to a film version of La Brava, which never happened.
Yeah, we spent a year with him.
Oh.
Yeah, and with him and with directors. Scorsese was the first one, and then Ulu Grossbard, and then different, there were a couple of others. And we would, Walter Mirisch, who was going to produce it, he and I would go to New York and just sit and wait for the meeting to have a meeting. And then Dustin would come over and we'd talk about it. And then he said, no, then he would change the storyline. Well, where's my girlfriend? I have to have a girlfriend in this, you know, things like that.
Did he also order off the menu?
Always did that, yeah. That's where I got that.
I would say that captured a lot of business deals, it seems like.
And they also don't know their zip code or their phone number if they're staying somewhere else.
Oh, wow. I say, if you're ever channel surfing and one of the films based on your books come on, do you watch it, or it depends on how good or how bad it is?
Well, no, I don't necessarily watch it. No.
Okay.
Uh-uh.
Well, it seems like, especially with your body of work, there's always a lot of what could have been, especially with the body of work that you've put out over the years.
Well, we're still at it. We're still trying to sell them, because there are a bunch of them that we like, that we think would make very good movies, and... You know, nothing's happened because the studios just aren't as active as they used to be. That's the trouble. But we've got some that I think Swag. We've got a script for Swag. Then Sparks, which was a short film.
Mm-hmm.
Sparks is now being written for FX. They're going to try that one. Cuba Libre, I think we've got to sell that one. That's a big picture. The Hot Kid, Tishomingo Blues would be a good movie.
Well, so, there's always possibilities.
Oh yeah, always.
I say, are you familiar with a website called The Onion?
No.
It's a satirical newspaper, but their entertainment section, they do real writing. I mean, the news articles are jokes, but they actually have a serious. Entertainment section, and every week they have a column called Gateways to Geekery. And what they do is they pick out like a 101 course on how to start with a particular filmmaker or a particular writer or a particular musician. And last week you were the subject. And they recommended Out of Sight as the as a good first step into checking out your body of work. So good things are written about you on the internet.
Well, I see the newspaper. I didn't know it was on the internet because I don't have a computer.
You don't write on a computer?
No, I write in longhand.
Yellow pads and then typewriter?
It's an unlined yellow pads that I have made. They're 8.5 by 11 unlined yellow, and I've been using them ever since I was with an ad agency where we use these kinds of pads. So I order them. Let's see, 63 pages to the pad, and then I get 100 pads.
How long would that last?
A year. No, not 100, 50. 50, okay. 50 pads.
You can make a commercial with those and get an underwriting.
Yeah.
Your own brand of pads.
I go through a lot of pages, you know, because it takes me anywhere from three to sometimes five. Just to get one clean page, because I'm not sure what the scene is, you know, until
sure.
I get into it. But I've been doing it for 60 years, and I have a good time. So
if it ain't broke,
yeah, right.
There you go, friends. From 2011, my epic chat with Elmore Leonard. Of course, he's always been a part of the film show since then because of his ID, and I'm all grateful for it. Thank you, Dutch. All right, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Once again, hope you get to watch some films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And we'll try this again next week. We're going to end this week's show. Yeah, 14th year 14 going on. A little audio tribute to Max Julian. Of course, I mentioned best known as Goldie from the Mac. So a great excuse to play the great song from Willie Hutch that appears in the Mac. It's been, yeah, I know it was also used in Hustle and Flow, but here's the original film for which that song came. Here's Willie Hutch and I Choose You. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!